huge news, years in the making, my brand new book that my publishers refuse to publish, Money Matrix. Beat the money system and build generational wealth. Understand the three main ways that the banks productize you and make money from you. You'll be able to turn that system against itself, build generational wealth and multiple streams of recurring income. It's all at moneymatrix.cash. And if you're quick, the first few hundred registrants and buyers will receive many special bonuses from me. The brand new Moneymaker Summit 3-day special event. Meet me at a champagne reception. Meet me at a multi-millionaire networking dinner. Go now, moneymatrix.cash. This is huge.
Welcome to the Disruptive Entrepreneur Podcast.
What does the word disruptive mean to you?
It means going beyond the ordinary, going beyond the status quo.
Not thinking in the conventional way, not just sort of following the herd.
Disruptive means taking things up, you know?
Disruptive entrepreneur is somebody who sees the problem and embraces the problem with a new way.
Shake up and awakening.
Quality will take care of itself, and you'll go from being disruptive, but also profitable.
When you use your own reservoir of talent, when you love what you do, then you disrupt.
Mix it up, change it up, and dominate.
And now, your host, 8 times best-selling author and double world record holder, Rob Moore.
Hello, and welcome to the Disruptive Entrepreneur Podcast. It's producer Harry here. Today's interview is with billionaire, Silicon Valley venture capital investor, Tim Draper. So Tim has been investing in all sorts of companies and stocks and things like that for around about 30, 35 years. And some of the investments in his portfolio include Skype and SpaceX. Someone with that amount of wealth of knowledge, Tim reveals in this interview how to perfectly invest in multiple companies and have a really diverse portfolio. And obviously this is with someone who's been there, done that for decades. Tim also reveals how he's made money during lockdown. Lockdown hasn't stopped him investing and finding avenues how to make money. So it's another billionaire we've had on the podcast. And again, there's a whole wealth of knowledge here, so get ready. But just before we get started, one final thing from me. We also have a YouTube channel, Rob Moore. If you go over and subscribe to the Rob Moore YouTube channel, you can access all sorts of videos that we do there, including this very video with Tim Draper. So we have all our interviews. They are available on the YouTube channel along with everything else we do. So make sure you head over to Rob Moore on YouTube and subscribe. So let's just get straight into the interview with billionaire Silicon Valley venture capital investor, Tim Draper. But remember, if you don't risk anything, you risk everything.
Hello, this is Rob Moore here. Welcome to the Disruptive Entrepreneur live broadcast. So we're coming to you on Facebook, on YouTube, on LinkedIn, and I have a very special guest today. So Tim Draper is here on the podcast with us. Tim, thank you very much for giving your time to do this podcast.
Good, my pleasure. Thanks for having me on the show, Rob.
So Tim doesn't really need an introduction, but I'm going to do it anyway. A lot of my guys in my office were very excited with this interview. We've got quite a few of my team who are pretty quite heavily into Bitcoin and crypto, so they were very excited. Now, Tim, you have a lot of companies. I was doing my research to try and find out exactly how many companies you have. I found Draper VC, Draper Associates, Draper University, Draper Venture Network. I'm sure there are more. So my first question to you is, does that define an entrepreneur, having multiple companies and interests?
Well, that's funny. I never really think of myself as an entrepreneur. I think of myself as a venture capitalist. But in growing my venture firms and building out my business, each time I come up with some kind of new model or innovative idea, we need to create something around it. And those are the vehicles that we've created around it. We actually have, there is a Draper Esprit, which is a listed venture capital firm in London. And they've been a very good partner of ours for a long time. We have a Draper Venture Network that they're a big part of. And so I'm very pleased to be talking to somebody who's spreading the word to all the people in the UK. Isn't that where the audience is here?
Yeah, yeah. I think the UK are catching up America a bit, Tim. So we're doing our best. So why are you so diverse? In fact, what would be really good, Tim, for those of us, you know, who aren't based in America, the diverse range of investments you have and why you are that diverse. And if you're not more diverse, why not?
So as a venture investor, you need to put your money into a variety of, as an early stage venture investor, you need to put your money into a variety of different companies because it's sort of one in 10 that makes it big. And so you've got to have at least 20 or 30 in any given fund. And if you've been around a long time, I mean, I've been investing for 34 years, and you accumulate companies as you go. And so over time, yeah, I've got a large accumulation of different companies, and we've seeded something like 36 unicorns in those 35 years, but we needed to be pretty diverse and try different things along the way. A big part of being an early stage venture capitalist is trying things and being willing to fail. And so I will meet somebody and they will be taking me and they'll say, hey, we're going to do electric cars. And I'll look at it and say, well, you know, why would I do a car company? You know, they've all failed over the last 50 years. But then I think, wow, these electric cars are really fun. And so I ended up backing Tesla. And then somebody else comes to me and says, hey, we're going to give away free web-based email. And I say, well, that sounds interesting. How are you going to make money? And they said, we don't know. But I still backed them anyway, and that became Hotmail. And then that was the beginning of all of the viral companies that I backed along the way, Skype and a number of others that that all use some sort of a viral effect. So in diversification came sort of naturally. And I guess I was the first Silicon Valley venture capitalist to go to China, for instance, and first one to fund anything in Estonia. There were a lot of firsts, but I kind of have always had that in my head. And I guess you can put a few things together. One of my grandfather was the first Silicon Valley venture capitalist. And my other grandfather was the guy who set up all the offices for Merrill Lynch around the world. And so I kind of, and then my dad was a great pioneer in venture capital. But I sort of put those two things together, and I've always had an international feel. I've always felt that the world was just one big globe that we should all explore. And so I started venturing outside of the Silicon Valley and pretty soon set up venture funds all over the world. And I kept the Draper brand on many of them, and I connect them all. Because everybody's better off because we all work together for best practices and that kind of thing. So, yeah, the diversification is just the nature of a natural growth path for my venture business. Oh, and the other things that have happened, the other things that I've built have been for deal flow for venture capital. So Draper University trains heroes, trains extraordinary people to become even more extraordinary. And that that they all seem to connect me with a lot of other entrepreneurs and bring more entrepreneurs into my fold. Draper startup houses, same thing. They're a natural attraction for entrepreneurs wherever they may be. And they send me a lot of deals and the Draper Venture Network, same thing. So, and then keeping a very high profile as Tim Draper and having had the exact same email address for many, many years, tim@draper.vc, I get all these business plans that come through that. So it's it seems very diverse, but it's really all around building venture capital because I've always loved entrepreneurs. I love what they do for the world. I love the progress that they bring us. They bring us and jobs they bring us and the wealth they bring us and the you know, happier people, and they explore the world in new ways. Entrepreneurs are just great for our world, and we need to support them in any way we can.
Amen to that. So many people say only invest in what you know, what you deeply understand. And it seems like you've invested in some things maybe you didn't initially understand because you're quite diverse. So do you have a model? Do you have a set of rules that you invest in a company or an entrepreneur by?
Yeah, I'm always looking for those entrepreneurs that are a little bit the outlier, because if I were to do just late stage investing, it would be pretty easy to know the entire field, because by the time they get that size, there are plenty of Google searches you can do, and you can, you know, some Wikipedia pages and whatever. You can do a lot of research on those companies. But if a company comes to me and they are doing something entirely new, there isn't that much research I can do. So I have to sort of just project out, what's the world going to look like 5, 10, 15 years from now if these guys are successful? And that's the question I ask. It's very different from many other venture capitalists who, when they're putting their money to work, they're saying, what could go wrong here? I think, what if it works? That's my big question. What if it works? If this thing works, then what's the world look like? And how great does it become? And how exciting does it become? And I think that that will, that actually for early stage venture capital is a better question. Mm. It's more exciting. It's one that gets people thinking about the future and what the future is going to look like. And people have sort of said, oh, Draper, how did you know Bitcoin was going to hit 10,000 at that exact date? How did you know that Bitcoin's going to be, think that it's going to be worth this much? Or how did you project that? I mean, God, how did you know that Tesla was going to be a big success? Well, I spend all this time interviewing entrepreneurs. They're all telling me what the future is going to look like. I have no idea what's going on today. In fact, this virus thing has been a blip on the screen for me. But the rest of the, what's going to happen in 5, 10, 15 years, I have a pretty good view of, because that's all I meet. I meet all these people who are trying to put a picture in my head of what the world's going to look like. And I start combining one with another, and then I get this view. And then that's the view that I espouse and I bet on as I make those investments.
Okay. So you used the word exciting quite a few times there. And I love hearing that from, you know, whether you call yourself an entrepreneur, businessman, a venture investor. For me, I always hear business and entrepreneurship. And I always get excited when I talk to people who get excited about business. So what's the most, or one of the most exciting investments or exciting companies you've backed, and why?
Well, I think I've backed some very exciting companies. You know, I think when we backed Hotmail and then later Skype, they allowed the entire world to communicate with each other free. And that opened up the world. The world suddenly was no longer this tribal strange thing where we have artificial borders and we're trying to protect ourselves from those people across the border. All of a sudden we realize the people across the border are great too. And the world economy just expanded because of those companies. And it became a very important thing to have global communication. You could start doing deals where in places you never thought you could, just because people had access to the internet. I think those two probably have had the biggest impact on the world. Although, you know, we backed Baidu. We were the first venture investors in China. We backed Baidu. And that allowed everyone in China to have access to all that information. And I think, you know, it's the Google for China. And I think that had a really big impact on the billion Chinese. So I think those really had a big impact. And now communications of all forms have taken us to, we back Twitch TV. And then I think that recently I got very excited that the financial world was about to go through a huge transformation. And so I ended up backing Robinhood and Carta and AngelList and Bitcoin itself and Coinbase in order to, because I thought, yeah, the world's going to go through a big transformation. People aren't going to want to pay the banks 2.5 to 4% every time they swipe their credit card. They're going to want the new frictionless currency that's going to be open and transparent and global, because the world's going to be global. So I guess that was the flow of where I went from, wow, global communications to global finance. And I think that the next step will be global governance, which would include insurance and real estate and a whole bunch of other fields that are going to go through major transformations, because governments now have to compete for us. Because if the world goes global, they either trap their people, which they're kind of doing right now, they either trap their people in place and they say, you can't move. Or they recognize that, hey, this is a global world. This is a global economy. We need to open it up. And for the good of our people, we want to have as much free trade as possible. I think that leads us toward governments that compete for us. And a lot of what governance does can be done at the virtual level. It can be done just with, you know, smart contracts and Bitcoin and artificial intelligence, and actually put the all the insurance parts of government together. So I think that that's kind of a direction I'm looking toward. I also think healthcare and data, this is sort of a, it's not a clear picture on the wave, but right now data can do a better job of diagnosing a patient than a doctor. And when combined with a doctor, they do even better. And the data that you can get on a patient isn't just about medical records. It could be blood test results and Fitbit results and genetic history and where you've, what you've eaten and what airplane seat you sat in and a whole bunch of other things and stuff that doctors would never think to ask. And then on the therapeutic side of healthcare, you're going to see, just as you have with COVID, you're going to see a disease here, and then you're going to see people to use computational biochemistry to determine what the drug is that's going to cure that disease. And you can do that much better and much faster through computational biochemistry than you can through a wet lab. And so that world is going to change in a big way. And the drugs that are developed are going to be specific to you. They're going to be bespoke drugs. They're not going to be like one size fits all, which is what most of the drug companies run on today.
Hi, it's Rob Moore here. I wrote in my book, Life Leverage, about leveraging your time. Let's be honest, no one is getting less busy. And two things that have really changed my life in terms of information and the speed of information is audiobooks on 2x speed and podcasts like this. But there's a company I believe that are really changing the game. They're called Blinkist, and they condense the best books into 15-minute summaries. Blinkist have an ever-growing library. I personally really like Sapiens. I also like Start With Why by Simon Sinek, and I think you will like it when all my books are on there. So right now, for a limited time, Blinkist have a special offer that I've agreed with them just for my podcast listeners. You need to go to Blinkist.com/Rob to start your 7-day trial. And Blinkist is spelt B-L-I-N-K-I-S-T. That's Blinkist.com/Rob to start your 7-day free trial. Blinkist.com/Rob. Right, let's get back into the episode.
Okay.
Thank you, Tim. So you talked a bit about the future there, but I want to go back in the past now, if that's okay, because I'm fascinated by how you built your empire. So maybe you could take us back right to the start where you can remember getting into the world now, and just take us on that little bit of a journey. Give us some highs and lows. I'm going to sit back for a few minutes and enjoy the show.
Okay, I will. My grandfather was the first Silicon Valley venture capitalist. My dad was a pioneer in venture capital, but he had left the venture business about 6 years before I got out of business school. And I went and I joined an investment bank as the token venture capitalist, and they didn't really want me to invest any money. I was just sort of, that was their way of getting me to be an investment banker. And so then I went out and I was able to take over these private companies that the SBIC, we had a government program, a small business investment company program, where if you could put up a dollar, they would put up three, and you could borrow that three and then pay it back 10 years later with interest. So I used that program, and I had some cats and dogs that were in my dad's portfolio before, and they were all private companies. And they added up to $2 million worth of value, or they were valued at $2 million. So I went to the SBA, and they allowed me to borrow $6 million against that. And I remember the guy going, he was going through the checklist, and he goes, well, wait, says here you got to have 10 years of investment experience. And I said, oh, I've been investing since I was 10. And he just looks at me and he goes, check. The bureaucracies never allow that stuff anymore. But this was, back then, that's the way it worked. And so I borrowed $6 million, and it looked, after 3 years, it looked like I had lost all the money, lost the borrowed money, lost the initial capital, and the SBA put me on their watch list, and then they put me on their dirt list. And I flew back to Washington. I said, don't call this loan. It's going to be okay. Hang in there. I wasn't sure, but I thought it might. And then the IPO window opened up. There used to be this sort of time that everybody would rush in, and everybody wanted to invest in public companies. And the window opened up, and I five of the companies I had backed went public in about a three-month period of time. And one of them is called Parametric Technology, became worth about, now it's, I think, over $10 billion. And we had an early investment in there, and that was able to pay back all of the loans and give my, my dad 15% return. And then I was clear, and I had made a bunch of money, and I put that money to work and raised a fund based on my record. Brought in a partner, John Fisher. The two of us went out and hustled up a $20 million fund, and then we started to put that to work. And then everything was great for a while. I brought in Steve Jurvetson. We ended up with this amazing fund, series of funds. We hit the internet just right. And then we really started to expand. We went global. I focused very much on the global businesses and the investments we made there. And those worked out pretty well because we did have Skype and Baidu. But there was also a time there where the investors were yelling at us, because it was 2001, I guess. The investors were saying, oh my gosh, you've lost us all this money, and how horrible, and whatever. And we ended up doing quite well with that international fund. But there was a period of time there where the markets came crashing down.
For years, people have been asking me where I buy my watches. Many of you may know I'm a watch collector, I'm a watch investor, and those as an asset class have done me very well in the last 15 years. I have never shared where I source my watches from or my watch dealer until now. My watch dealer used to be a professional footballer for Manchester United, and he formed a watch brand called Broadwalk. And he sources the higher-end brands like Rolex, Audemars Piguet, Patek Philippe and Richard Mille. I trust him, I've used him for many years, and recently we've done a partnership. Hence, I'm inviting you, if you want to start investing in watches and protect your money from the banks and inflation, to check out Broadwalk. That's Broadwalk. And the website is broadwalkgroup.com. The email is sales@broadwalkgroup.com. And please don't share this, but his number is 07496 878153. Obviously, only message him if you're serious about buying and investing in the higher-end watches. People have been asking me for years, and for the first time ever, you can get access to my watch team.
And we felt like we had to take all the blame for it. And it was good. It was good experience because we kind of figured out what we were made of. And we realized that we could stand up in front of all those people who thought they'd lost all their money and say, hey, you know, we got your money into the places we said that we were going to put it into. This is a crash and we're suffering through a crash. We're all in it together. Like when they're talking about, we're all in it together on the virus. And we were hoping things start to pick up, and it turned out they did. We were able to keep going. And then when things went very well, I decided to go solo, separate from the partnership. My partnership, I had grown it to 14 or something partners, and I couldn't get deals done. So I was feeling like, you know, I want to go back to getting deals done. And so I started doing that again, and I really enjoyed this. And during this time where it's solo, I made Bitcoin bet. I made some amazing, I got lucky with some amazing investments around crypto, around self-driving cars, and Twitch TV, and a whole bunch of others that seem to be doing incredibly well. So I'm glad I went solo. But that was a big decision too, leaving your partnership to, partnership that I built and starting over. And by starting over, I was able to start Draper University of Heroes. I was able to expand the Draper Venture Network. And I was able to sort of run it the way I wanted to run it, as opposed to a partnership where you have to kind of be a good debater to win the argument to get something done. Now I can just kind of be the dictator, and it's been working out very well. I'm sort of dictator, but I also have, investment committees and all that stuff I have to go through. But it's a lot easier to get things done than it was with the 14 partners. So there, I gave you sat back. You got to hear this story, and now you can ask me another question.
Yeah. So why do you do what you do?
I love it. The people ask me, well, what's a good day? A good day is when I meet a true entrepreneur, somebody who is going to dedicate their life to something, whether I invest in them or not. They have just decided to do it, and it's a train leaving the station. If I want to get on the train, I can get on the train. And if I don't, then I miss the boat or miss the train. So those are the people who I do it for. I think once you've had enough success to sort of, make sure all your kids get through college and all that, there's something else. And that is, I look back and I think, wow, I backed some companies that have had a huge impact on the world. And so that has, in some ways, it's raised the bar for me, because I'm saying, look, every time I meet an entrepreneur, I've got to feel like this thing, if it works, it's got to make a huge impact on the world. And so I'm always looking at the entrepreneur that way. I'm saying, are you going to be the one who makes this huge impact on the world? And what does the world look like at that point? Is it a better world or worse? It's rarely a worse world, but is it significantly better? Does it move us? Like, does it get us to Mars? Or does it cure cancer? Or does it, you know, get us so that we can teleport or whatever? Or is it something where it's like, yeah, I can do a little bit better social media thing? I think it's got to have an impact where I feel like, wow, this person is so unique that they're going to make it happen. Anyway, that's what gets me going in the morning. I get excited, even in this like lockdown thing. I still get dressed up. You know, I got my Bitcoin tie on. And I say goodbye to my wife. I say bye, honey. And then I just close the door to my home office. And here I am in my home office. And then I work here all day. And then at the end of the day, I come back. I say, honey, I'm home. And I just keep at it because I feel like I don't want to. I want to make sure I'm driving it forward. I want to make sure that I'm not sitting in pajamas eating pizza, you know, destroying my life just because these guys, the government says to lock down. I feel like this is a really important time. In fact, it's so important now for a venture capitalist because the entrepreneurs, the small businesses are the ones who create all the net new jobs. And this government lockdown has created 40 million unemployed in the US and 400 million around the world that are unemployed. As a venture capitalist, I look at that as a responsibility on my shoulders. I got to back the companies that are going to get big enough to employ all those people. And so that gets me going. A lot of things get me going. But the other thing is, it's so exciting, and it started with Bitcoin, a decentralized currency, a global currency. All of a sudden, this decentralized world is opening up to us, where governments have to compete for us. It's a new world. It's an open, transparent, happy world that in the next 15 years, we're going to see. And I want to push to get there sooner.
Okay. I'm with you all the way there, Tim. So you invest a lot of money that is not your own. And does that take a certain type of person because you've lost other people's money? I'm sure. And I know some people would find that hard. How do you manage such huge amounts of money that aren't your own?
Yeah. Well, it's less and less as a percentage. So if I'm losing your money, it's usually because I'm losing more of my own. And so I don't feel that. I feel like, hey, I'm giving it my all, and it's my own money in there. So, you know, it's a lot easier for me to think about now than it was before. Before I put in a very small amount of money. I didn't have much. Put in a small amount of money, and I would raise a lot of money alongside it, and I had made a lot of money for a lot of people at the beginning. And then when the markets came crashing down 2001 to 2008, we made a lot of money for a lot of people on our international fund, but our domestic fund did not. Two funds did not. And that is hard. That's one of those things where I keep thinking, well, you know, maybe we'll have another big win there somewhere. You know, the companies have been around for 15 or 20 years. Maybe they'll get a kick or something, and we'll be eventually able to get these guys 100% of their money back. We're usually pretty close to getting all their money back, even in a horrible bear market. But then if they'd stayed with us the whole way, then they would have done very, very, very well, even though they would have had ups and downs and fits and starts. So, yeah, it's a, I feel that responsibility, but there's something else. I like being an institution. It helps me with a whole bunch of other things. So if I'm a fiduciary, which means I am taking care of somebody else's money, then I can negotiate from that position rather than just it's my money and I'm an angel and I throw the money around. I'm investing as a fiduciary. I have to invest under these terms because I have to be looking out for my partner's money to get them their return too. And that creates a stronger negotiating position with our entrepreneurs. And it also makes sure that I'm taking very good care of their money. And in doing so, I'm taking good care of my own money.
Okay. So this is a 4-in-1 question. I've never asked a 4-in-1 question before. Wikipedia has.
And I'll take a.
So Wikipedia has your net worth at around 1 billion. So my 4 questions are, 1, how accurate is that? 2, has it gone up or down in the lockdown? 3, what's the upside of being so wealthy? And 4, what's the downside of being so wealthy?
Interesting. When I played Monopoly, I never showed anybody how much money I had. So so that you're not going to get out of me. Up or down, I am surprisingly up on the lockdown. And here's what's happened. First, Bitcoin's done very well, and I have a lot of Bitcoin. And other cryptocurrencies have done very well, and I have a lot of other cryptocurrencies. And the dollar has gone crashing down, or will go crashing down. I don't know if it has yet, but it will because they've printed $9 trillion of it. And so they're not as strong a commodity as they used to be. And where I thought the lockdown was really going to hurt our companies, turns out it did hurt the companies that are capital intensive, the ones that have physical objects for sale, but the ones who are tied to VR because when people have been locked down, they've put the VR equipment on and they've tried stuff. And the ones that are tied to Bitcoin have done very well because when people have been tied down, they've been saying, well, what is all this about Bitcoin? I might as well go try to get a wallet. And so a lot of people the number of Bitcoin wallets has exploded during that. And I think also people are saying, wait a second. You know, I really had a lot of confidence in the dollar until they decided to print 9 trillion of them. They started to lose a little of that confidence. And some people went and said, well, I'll put it into gold. And I've always thought of gold as, you know, a weird cyclical commodity. But Bitcoin, there are only 21 million of them. And they are going to be more and more valuable as you see governments have less and less, where the citizens are less and less confident in their government's ability to manage a currency. Upside of being rich is it's I don't worry too much when I spend money. I think that's a nice upside. So I'm not looking at a restaurant bill. I'm not too worried if my car breaks down. And these are things that I used to really care about when I was starting out. The downside is also an upside. The downside is I get mobbed by people who are starting businesses and want money or just want money. But the benefit of that is I get great deal flow from that. And so that has been a very helpful thing. And then I don't have to, there are things where I don't have to worry about. I don't have to worry about a mortgage now. And I appreciate all of the things that I used to have to worry about. since I used to have to worry about them, I do understand that it is, it's tough living. A lot of people live paycheck to paycheck. And now my heart really goes out to the people who are, you know, somebody who's a waitress and has three kids. You know, what do you do? There's no, you know, you got to come up with a new job. You got to figure it out. You got to get back on the treadmill somehow. And anybody who doesn't have a job, that kills me, because that's when people start going off the rails emotionally. They get into drug use. They get into problems. I think I've been lucky that way. I've been lucky in that I never took drugs. I don't drink. And it has, that has helped me a lot, because I'm always kind of, whatever the brain cells I had, I've still got many of them. I've lost some, but I've got many of them. And I think that, struggling for money can take up a huge part of your brain. And if you're not struggling for money anymore, you're thinking about the good of the long-term good of society, you have a much broader view, and you can make investments that are much longer term. And so I think that might be the best part of it. If I'm thinking, you know, looking meal to meal, that's all I got on my plate. If I'm thinking paycheck to paycheck, I'm just thinking, all I think about is a week at a time. If I'm thinking, well, I've got enough money to take care of myself, then that solves one problem. But then if I have enough money to invest and to help other people become successful, then I can start thinking about, well, how is that going to help society? You know, what's the long term? What can I do? And I don't have to think short term at all. I can just think long term. And I think that frustrates a lot of the people around me, because I'm, you know, when everybody's locked down on COVID, I'm saying, yeah, you know, you're saving some lives short term. Long term, you're destroying lives. And I'm not sure, and I'm looking at the numbers, and I'm not sure that we didn't destroy more lives than we saved. And so I was not for the idea of lockdown. I was not for the idea of people wearing masks. I always thought that was like a sheep thing. I'm a freedom guy, and I'm thinking long term, it's important for all to be free. So I guess that must be the benefit, is that I can think longer term, and then the people around me might be saying, well, you know, you're killing people if you don't stay 6 feet apart and keep a mask on. And part of me thinks, well, you know, that may be, but you're killing more by shutting down all these restaurants and travel, and you know that ends up being much worse long term. And if we're all locked in place and we're all doing exactly what the government tells us to do, we're not a free people anymore. And I think I can think that way, probably because I am not concerned about my next meal. And I'm also, you know, I'd be willing to die for freedom, for the freedom of my grandchildren and their children and their children. I would definitely be willing to make the personal sacrifice.
Wow. So changing subject, we've got, I think I'll probably take one more fairly long question, as long as you want, Tim. And then, because I want to make sure we respect your time, we'll do a quick fire and I'll give you the sort of rough time we've got left. This fascinates me because in my first 10 years of being an entrepreneur, I probably had as many PAs, as many assistants, probably about 10. I wasn't very good at keeping them. And from my research, it looks like you've had the same personal assistant for 30 years. So you win that one. And I also understood you did a lot of interviews to find the right person. So can you give me some hiring and retaining advice, please?
It was really interesting. Well, she was my first hire. Wow. So I was very careful. And I interviewed 75 different possible assistants before I hired her. And I kept thinking, God, can't they find me the person for this? You know, and I kept looking and looking and looking. And then all of a sudden somebody, my ex-brother-in-law said, hey, well, this woman, our company's going bankrupt and this woman's available. You might want to talk to her. And I met her, and within like 10 minutes, I said, well, how much were you making there? And I knew she was about to lose her job there. And I said, okay, well, I'll make it. I guess I gave her something about 8% higher than whatever she was making there. And I said, you know, let's go. And she accepted right on the spot, and we've never looked back. Yeah, I've been in the business now 35 years. She's been with me for 33 years. And she runs the place. And I think it depends on whether you're getting rid of the assistants or they are bailing on you as to what advice I would give you. I think if they're leaving you, you better look inside and think about how do I keep them? If you're getting rid of them, then I think you have to think, you know, what is it that you really want in an assistant? What's the thing that is going to really help drive you forward? And I have found there are people who are just really good at helping. They look, they anticipate everything you need, and they just are good at it. And she is so good at it. Mm-hmm. I think that's what you want in an assistant, I think, is somebody who kind of knows already before mm-hmm. you even, you know, it's halfway out of your mouth and she goes, oh yeah, here, yeah. You know, or I'll say, who is that guy? And she'll say, you know, George Schmergel. And I go, oh yeah, that's right. How did you, all I said was, who is this guy? So we kind of share a brain. Fortunately, hers is very good.
And, you know, I don't care how good someone is and how good you are. 33 years is impressive to work with someone. That must take some work. So how do you maintain really long relationships in business, partnerships, you know, with staff? Because obviously you're saving a recruitment fee every 2 years. So you're saving 15, 16 recruitment fees. You're saving training, you're saving employment tribunals. That's saving a lot of money.
Well, she makes a ton of money, so we're good there. I think it's a communications thing. We now share the same office, so that's a nice thing. Mm-hmm. So she always knows what's going on. And I think that helps. I think if you're in two different places, it's a little tougher. And then, you know, I worked with the same partners for a very, very long time, and we worked very well together for a very long time. And going solo was very difficult for me because I felt like I was breaking with all those good relationships. Think of it as a relationship. Think of it as a family. I think those are always good things to think about.
Yeah. Okay. Great. So now let's move into the quick fire. So I reckon we've got maybe 5-6 minutes left. So I'll pick about 6 of these. So you can do about 1 minute each, Tim. It's up to you, sounds of course, great. If you want to do less. But the first thing would be, what one asset or skill would you say has got you where you are today?
I think it's a people sense and an understanding of people's motivation. I think that's probably what I'm good at. Oh, I've also had a pretty good skill since I came up with the idea for to spread Hotmail around the world. The idea for PS I love you, get your free email at Hotmail. It spread around the world very, very quickly. So I started to realize that you want to make your customer into your sales force. So I ended up coming up with good, I have a good way of helping people think about their business model. I think that's another thing.
Okay.
But there are a lot of flaws in this one here.
Well, I didn't ask that, Tim, so you don't have to worry about that.
I know. I'm sure that's the next question.
What advice would you give to the young or nouveau riche? So the people who've just started to become successful but don't have, you know, decades of experience like you, what piece of advice would you give them?
Well, I would keep making money and I would not spend it. I would stay frugal, stay with what it was that helped you make the money, and feel good about money, because when you've earned it, that means you've made a deal with somebody that worked out very well for the two of you. And whenever you make a deal with somebody, you're both going to be better off. At least that's the ambition, is for both of you to be better off. So continue to make deals, continue to think in terms of growing your wealth and spreading your wealth, and help people become more successful, like people like you become more successful. I think that's a healthy attitude. You want to just keep putting it back out there so that it can grow and multiply, or you lose it. I mean, it comes and it goes, and feel fine with both. You know, make sure that you're covering your family and whatever else you need to cover. But beyond that, just think in terms of, hey, what do I feel is going to be good use of this money? And that is usually not putting it into a nonprofit. That's usually putting it into a for-profit, because by making money, those businesses can spread and spread a goodwill around the world a lot faster and a lot more efficiently than a nonprofit that has to keep asking you for money.
Hmm. Why did you accept this podcast interview?
I heard you were a big deal.
Correct. thank you, Tim. You've made
I'm glad I did. I like these questions. They've gotten me to think in new ways. So good. Thank you for that.
My pleasure. Thank you. This one's from one of our community members, Natalie Bailey.
Yeah, another thing is my dad taught me something. He said, if there's any question in your mind, just say yes. You get so much farther and your life is so much more full if you just say yes. It's it can be a magic word.
And what gives you the most
joy? Get on to your next question.
Yeah, no, sure. No, I'm listening. What gives you the most joy in life?
You know, my kids, and then in work, it's really being able to back people who are, you know, have the potential to do something really extraordinary. Those are the things that give me the most joy.
What's been the hardest thing for you to learn in your whole career?
Well, it's interesting. I learned that I have an instinct for this business, and you'd say that, well, that isn't hard. It turns out it is hard, because then I realized that all the partners I hired don't have that instinct. And so I realized that's a weakness of mine, that I wasn't able to train them properly, or didn't have the wherewithal to make them all, some really do, but to make them all think the way I do toward creating great entrepreneurs. I think that may have been the toughest thing I faced. Also, it was always tough. It's really funny. When things are really great or they're really bad, those are tough times. When it's really great, you start losing people because they think that this is easy. And when they get really bad, you lose people because they've lost faith in you. So those are the tough times.
Okay, so these are the closing questions, and we ask these to every guest. These are ones that we ask that are the same throughout. The best advice you can remember ever receiving.
Yeah, it came from my grandfather, my father, and my father to me, and I've passed it on to my kids, and that is, it doesn't matter who's buying or who's selling. It's just the human connection that matters. And having that connection, having the ability to do a deal with somebody, do something for somebody that'll make their life better and make your life better. You should always be proud to sell or buy or help or take help.
And what's the worst advice you can remember ever receiving?
The worst advice usually is driven around fear. It's usually the bad advice usually comes from people who are trained to tell you all the things that could go wrong. And that's usually lawyers or accountants. But they can give you good advice, that is good legal advice, but they are not necessarily giving you the best advice overall. And so generally the worst advice comes from people who are scaring you. And I think every bad decision I've ever made was made based on fear. Doesn't mean the ones that were made on opportunity were all good. It just means that the worst decisions were all fear driven. So I try not to let fear get into my mind. Yeah, if you ever read Dune, the science fiction novel, they say, Frank Herbert says, fear is the mind killer. And it is. You put fear into people's heads, they ruin their lives. They'll give their mind over to the media. They'll follow like sheep. They won't have their own opinion. They'll be afraid. They won't try anything new. Fear is a mind killer.
Is there anything wrong with the world that you would like to change?
Yeah. I actually think customs and borders. I think down the road, this is going to be one world. We are not going to be tribal anymore. We're going to be global. And governance is going to be an industry where the best people, the people who provide the best governance, are going to be the ones who get the payments, the taxes, the whatever. I think a lot of governance can now be done by computer. And so a lot of people in government are kind of going, well, wait, what's my role? And so they're pulling back and they're sort of becoming even more aggressively tribal. But that's the thing that I think is going to happen over the next 10 to 20 years. And it's going to be really transformative for the world. And at the end of it, while it goes on, there will be all sorts of turmoil. But at the end of it, I think it'll be the most peaceful and loving world that we could ever imagine. So that, I think, is a great thing to aspire to.
Is there one person that, imagine you were watching this show, whether you're on LinkedIn or Facebook or the podcast, that you would love to watch be interviewed the most?
Oh, well, my dad is fantastic. I mean, I've learned the most from him, I think. Maybe my mom, but she died. Who should you interview?
Yeah. Who you would like to watch if I was interviewing them? Yeah.
Yeah. I'd pick a few. I'd say Peter Thiel, Mark Eason, Elon Musk. I would only pick people who think for themselves.
Yeah. Is he frozen there or is he still there? Harry, help me.
Hi, it's Harry again. So,
Unfortunately, Tim's connection cut out and he never returned to finish the interview. But we recorded this interview live and it was a bit of a spur of the moment thing. Me and Rob decided to do a debrief. So we took some of your questions live and we had a chat about the interview. Now, if this is something you enjoyed, let us know, because we might actually end up doing more content like this after our interviews. So let us know. So let's just get straight into the debrief.
We've got loads and loads of comments. I think you can see them on the side here. Do you just want to start scrolling through some of them, answering along?
Yeah, people are talking about my calm face under pressure of losing the... Yeah, Kohar said here she loves his optimism. I think what a lovely, positive, energetic, excitable... man, I definitely hope that Tim can get back because I want to promote his book. Been very kind to answer a lot of questions. So I'm going to tell you now in case he isn't, but he's got a book called Startup Hero. And I don't think that needs any selling to you. I think that's obvious that you should go grab that book, Startup Hero. He gave his email address out. So that's a pretty cool thing. He also gave his phone number out at the start, but we weren't live then. Okay, Harry, what did you think? Come in, Harry, because we should start doing this more, by the way. After the Jordan Belfort interview, you and I had a chat afterwards about what we thought. We should do this more. So what did you think? And be honest.
I really enjoyed that. I actually didn't know too much about Tim before we did this. Obviously, the headlines with Tim, he's a Silicon Valley billionaire. Something I was really surprised about, he's actually created quite some interesting, decisive debates within the comments. So I can see loads of comments here. And it kind of ranges from people really loving what he's talking about, you know, regarding entrepreneurship, really loving like his positivity, obviously his message about, you know, freedom. You can really see he was really passionate about that. So people, you know, like they normally do, lambasting billionaires and stuff like that. It was a lot more decisive than I thought it was going to be. A lot more polarizing. Very interesting.
There were some people lambasting billionaires, were there, in the comments? That's probably LinkedIn, isn't it?
Yeah. Because, you know, you use the word billionaire, Silicon Valley, people then assume, you know, conspiracy theories and all that good stuff, Rob. So,
yeah, well, I liked it. When he said, when I asked him about his net worth, basically in a roundabout way, but I don't like saying, what's your net worth? I think it's a little bit grotesque, but I want to know their net worth. So I've got to find a way of asking, because it's interesting, isn't it? And I like, I said, well, you're not getting that out of me, because when I played Monopoly, I never told people how much money I got. I thought that was a brilliant answer. I get him on the whole thing about not taking for granted the fact that you can repair your car. I just sent my Lamborghini Aventador down for a service, and that's eye-watering, but I don't have to worry about that. I never used to be able to afford to go out and eat. About 17 years ago, I was with a girlfriend of mine and I was at my skintest point, and she had to buy dinners and she had to take me out and she always had to pay for me. And I hated it. I felt really like just shame, I guess. And now when I go out for a meal, I really appreciate it, even if it's, you know, a 30 or a 40 pound meal. And, you know, a lot of people, you know, think that there's not that there's something wrong with being rich. Obviously, people who follow me are entrepreneurs. They love being rich and they want to be rich. But the thing he said about not worrying about being skint, so you can think about bigger things, that's a massive thing. I always said in my book, Money, that, you know, you think about money more when you're poor because you haven't got any. You're always trying to figure out how to get some and pay the bills. Once you've got enough, you're not really thinking about money anymore. You're thinking about growth and scale and contribution and solution and entrepreneurship and all those kind of exciting things. I don't really think that much about money anymore compared to how I used to. You think about money a lot more when you've got the problems. So do yourself a favor, make a good amount of money, make some money something you don't have to think about too much, and then you can go and do meaningful work. And he articulated that really well. I thought he articulated the question about what's wrong with the world that you want to change. That was the most unique answer we've had. Because usually you'll get the climate change, or you know, you'll get some, you know, common things, which are obviously important. But that, I thought that was a really unique answer. I also thought, I'll tell you one thing, I was worried like hell. You might have noticed I was very still and very quiet, and I asked a question and I shut up. And there's a couple of reasons for that. One, after the interview with Derek Sivers, I was just trying that as a sort of an evolution of my technique. Because people actually like it when I'm conversational with my guests. But two, there was probably about a second delay on the connection. And that's really, it's really hard to interview someone when there's a second delay, because you can't have a dialogue. You cannot, because it doesn't work. So I was like, ask my question, shut up. Ask my question, shut up. So in case you thought that's why I did it, but I think we did well. Only at the very end did I once speak over him, and that's not easy to do, or not easy not.
Right. What were you most surprised about Tim? What did you not know that you now know?
I didn't actually know all the companies he backed. I knew of Tesla and Skype. I didn't know of Hotmail. And that campaign he talked about, the PS I Love You campaign, that was huge. I remember that. And, you know, him being essentially basically the creator of that, that's impressive. Yeah. It's difficult. I didn't really have a preconception, Harry, because I try not to. He's probably a bit warmer than maybe I expected, and he was probably a bit more passionate than I expected in his art. It sounds like he's, you know, a few people are, oh, well, your dad did it, and his dad did it before you, so, you know, you're really, an entrepreneur, you're really successful because your parents did it. Well, his passion came through, I thought, and so therefore... You know, I think that puts that one to bed. Any other questions? I love interviewing billionaires. I just think it's fascinating. You know, there aren't that many of them. There's only a few thousand of them. So they are, to a certain degree, unicorns. I think they know things that people, mere mortals at a much smaller level, do not know. I just think you get a fascinating insight. For years, I've been saying, billionaires are not what you think. If you think they are greedy, power hungry, evil capitalist bastards, which a lot of opposite of that, communists, socialists, or, you know, whatever might think, or pseudo versions of those. And we have never, ever interviewed a billionaire that I haven't really admired and really liked or thought is greedy and power hungry. Never. Harry, how have you seen the podcast evolve? You know, what do you think of the work we're doing, and where do you want to see it going?
I think there's been a massive growth, particularly in the past year. Not just in terms of numbers, in terms of the podcast, in terms of YouTube and all that, but just a development in the concept and the ideas and the risks that we seem to be taking. Again, with the content that you talk about, a lot about mental health over the past year. The risks you've taken with the people you've interviewed, you spoke about likes of Katie Hopkins, how much shit you got for that one. And, you know, I think you pulled it off. And what I want to see from all of us is take more risks. With no risk, there is no reward. And as you say, Rob, if you don't risk anything, you don't risk, you know your very famous face. So yeah. I think we're doing more of that. And I thrive and enjoy taking these risks, particularly when we get big wins. So I'd say more risk.
Okay, well, look, I'm up for taking more risks.
Yeah, within reason.
I want to keep taking some risks. I don't know what that necessarily looks like. I think taking risks with questions, you know, asking Jordan Belfort when was the last time he took drugs, that's a risk. asking people their net worth when you know they don't really want to be asked, that's a risk. So I always said to you, Harry, I want my guests to come off my show and really enjoy it. And feel like that was a good use of an hour. I really enjoyed it. Like, of course, I'd like them to like me, but then I'm going to make friends with a lot of them, but a lot of them are not going to remember me and they're going to move on with their life. But I want them to really enjoy that hour and feel like it was good value to them. So that's why I've never really wanted to be a journo or to ask really hard questions or be a bit interrogative, etc. But because I wanted to do that with Jordan, because the interrogative questions were ones I wanted to ask. And Katie, I had to, didn't I? I couldn't go in all soft with Katie Hopkins. I had to ask those questions. I think that's opened up another realm to us where I can take some risks with those questions. But what's happened is my audience has got so used to me building good rapport with my guests. Some of them found the Jordan one a bit cold. But I was okay with it.
Why? Why are you okay?
I was okay with it because I didn't want to pretend to be his mate because I wasn't. And it wasn't that I wasn't, I just wasn't. And so people were expecting a lot more rapport and banter. But when he's sitting there slating Grant Cardone, who I'm friends with, I'm not going to sit there laughing at him. I'm just going to listen. So I felt like I needed my own integrity there to just remain enough distance. You know, like when you meet someone for the first time and you're not sure, you're going to stand back a little bit, aren't you, for a little while? Surely that's just smart. And I think people misread that. And by the way, some people said, oh, you could have got more out of him. I asked him 23 questions in 48 minutes or something like that. I've never asked anyone 23 questions. I asked David Icke about one question in about a 3-hour episode. So I gave him a good go at going deep.
How hard is that? Because I know personally it's not within your nature to have a game plan to go and expose someone. And I know, just as a person, as a human being, you want to be warm and charming, you know, charming and open with people. So how was it going into like the Jordan Belfort interview in that kind of bit more reserved manner?
Yeah, it was different because you're right. I want to be all warm and fluffy and cuddly. I want to pull good content out of them. I want to give you your sound bites, but I want them to enjoy it. I want my listeners to get really good value. So I don't ask all the gimmicky questions that aren't content driven, but we kind of did to more of a degree, didn't we, with Jordan? Because I guess he's that kind of caricature. So yeah, I was a bit more nervous about that. But I also wanted to challenge myself. So I just went in with a bit more of a game face and, you know, not so much rapport at the start, cracked on with it, got the job done. Yeah, I didn't feel like there wasn't rapport there. It's harder to build rapport when you're on Skype or Zoom, you know, thousands of miles away. It's much harder than when you're with them face to face. And we've got some great guests coming up face to face, by the way, when the lockdown is over. Great guests. Some of the big names we decided to not interview online and wait. We've got three really amazing guests agreed that are, you know, really amazing. I'm really excited about it. And I'll be able to create a lot more rapport with them because I'll be, sitting next to them and speaking to them for half an hour before. And you can't do that on a Skype or a Zoom. So it's a different game. And yeah, you know, Harry, I'm always way more keen going to meet him. I'd fly to America. Harry and Kieran, I'd fly you to America for the right guest. Arnold Schwarzenegger, I'm flying to America. Job done. Elon Musk, I'll fly to America. Go wherever they want to go. Because I still think you get a better show when you're face to face. But obviously in lockdown, it's challenged me again to do them remotely.
What do you think Tim's answer would have been to what does disruptive mean to him? You didn't get to ask him that. So what do you think in the 44 minutes you had with him, what do you think his response would have been?
I don't know. I don't know. I think companies that change the future, he might have said, because he was talking about the future, wasn't he?
Mm.
You know, companies that change the world, companies that connect, you know, the masses, like he talked about Skype and Hotmail being companies that connect the world. So I think he might have said those things. Cool. I reckon we should call it a day. If you like these little debriefs, let us know. And we might debrief. We won't necessarily do 30 minutes. But if you like the debriefs and us talking about the guest afterwards, and if you want to be involved in that Q&A, let us know. And we'll do it. I want to get Harry and Kieran and Tom more involved in the front end of the show. Harry obviously does some of the intros. I hope you're up for that, Harry. I know you've always respected that the show isn't about you, but it is because you're heavily involved in it. So we need to have more Harry. We should interview you one day, Harry.
Get me drunk, then interview me.
Yeah, I'll take you to Burger and Lobster and get you pissed. Because I reckon we could pull something good out of that, the best moments. What's it like from your perspective? You know, the creative direction of the show. You know, all those kind of things.
I'm going for that. That sounds all right.
All right. Cool. So make sure you go and follow Tim Draper on all socials. Make sure you grab his book. I believe it's called... Yeah, Startup Hero. So his book, Startup Hero, please support. I mean, look, he doesn't need your money, but he also gave his email address if you want to pitch him for your unicorn future company. I've really enjoyed this. Thanks for tuning in. And remember, if you don't risk anything, you risk everything. Over and out.